And in studying for this week, I'd like to read you something else and maybe apologize just a little bit for putting these kinds of pictures in our head and studying it, because I'm not sure I did what I am called to do, let's put it that way. The premise of the movies is that Bithia, by the way, Bithia was not really Pharaoh's daughter's name. At least we don't get that from Scripture. We get it from the Midrash. But raised Moses as her own son. Pharaoh's daughter raised Moses as her own son, keeping the fact that she was not his natural mother a secret. You remember that from the Ten Commandments, right? Nobody knew. Absolutely nobody knew. She kept it a secret. Even Ramesses believes himself to be Moses' brother. Moses, learning that he's really a Hebrew, is a crisis that leads Moses to explore life amongst his own people. That premise that Moses' identity as a Hebrew was a closely guarded secret is taken for granted in many popular takes on the life of Moses. For instance, in the animated Prince of Egypt from 1998, Moses learns that he's a Hebrew when, after stopping a taskmaster who's whipping Jochebed, his own mother, but unbeknownst to him, his sister Miriam says, "You were saved from the river, Moses. You were placed in a basket like a little ark and set upon the Nile, and you were found by the princess. You're the baby I saved. You're my little brother, Moses. You were born of our mother, Jochebed. You're one of us." This is how, in that movie, he finds out who he is. Shocked, though, Moses at first denies it and says, "That's not true. You're confused. You must be." But Miriam responded emphatically, "No, it's true. You were brought to the palace, but you came from here, from our people, from the Hebrews." This leads Moses in the next scene to start struggling with his identity, asking the question, "Who am I?" It's a beautiful song, by the way, what he sings. In 2014, the movie Exodus, Gods and Kings, Moses goes to Pithom to investigate some unrest and ends up in a cave where Nun, the father of Joshua, tells Moses about his having been a baby in the river found by Pharaoh's daughter, Bithia. Moses confronts Bithia with this. She admits that it's true. Again, the underlying premise is that Moses' identity as an adopted Hebrew is Bithia's closely guarded secret, and Moses, even himself, doesn't know. Whatever you're reading in the Exodus, how many here kind of agree with this narrative? And did you ever ask where it may have come from? That Moses' identity had to be a secret from what would become his adopted grandfather as Pharaoh, down to his own brother as Pharaoh, that it had to be a secret, his Hebrew identity. See, I found at times that much of what I think makes the covenant work is that God somehow puts the pieces together and that it always works out. In other words, the Hollywood version of the covenant. I don't want to make it sound like anything from Hollywood is a disdain. Actually, the human version of the covenant. That it always works out. Especially when it comes to the children that the covenant is given to, the humanity, the people, the ones that he chose for the covenant to live in. The movie version, my version, seems to emphasize what works in this kingdom. Powers conveniently appropriated. The seeming good guys always coming out on top, eventually, even with some revenge thrown in there. We like that. All predicated on how we view it and whose side we're on. I'm afraid last week I might have contributed that to a little bit when I introduced you to Moses, when I introduced you to the newest carrier, child, steward of the covenant that will make the covenant Mosaic. He'll get his own name placed upon the covenant, the Mosaic covenant. And I may have made a mistake by introducing you the way that I did. I told you, he'll become the covenant's most eloquent voice, an extraordinary prophet. And I may have maybe hinted that God has finally found his man. After looking through humanity and not being able to find anyone, he finally has found this one extraordinary man that could pull this off. But that isn't what the text tells us. And it isn't what the covenant reveals to us. Do you think that the covenant has finally found a good man? I know I gave Carolyn a mouthful, but I love the idea that the prophet says God is just looking for that one man. And according to the prophet, does he find him? No. As a matter of fact, after he cannot find that man, there is no one, he says. The prophet said, it is completely far from us. And when he realizes that he can't find one, according to Isaiah, he says, I'll just do it myself. So, is Moses that man? Is he the one? Is this why God chose him? Let's take a look at the introduction to the Mosaic Covenant. See what Scripture can do for us. And maybe your mind might be changed as mine was. It starts off ominously. It's a very ominous tone. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. See, up until now, Joseph's relatives have thrived in there ever since Joseph was around. And they always did it based on what? That every Pharaoh knew who Joseph was. Every Pharaoh understood the deal that they have with this people living in the land of Goshen. All of a sudden, arises one that does not what? Does not know Joseph. All he knows of Joseph is that he's not real thrilled with his family. He's not real thrilled with whatever deal his ancestor made with this faraway Hebrew ancestor of Joseph. He's not thrilled with him at all. He does not like what he sees. He says to his people, look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal what? Shrewdly, harshly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, they will join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. See, the rules of the powers of the earth, this is bad news. This is bad news for the most powerful leader in the world. He fears a rebellion from the inside. He has fears of oppression from these people. So Pharaoh's going to fight with Pharaoh's playbook. He's going to fight with the playbook of the kingdom of this world. He will fight before you have a chance to oppress me. I'm going to what? I'm going to oppress you. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses, for who? For Pharaoh. He enslaves them. He takes away their autonomy. Everything they make will no longer be for them. It'll be for who? It'll be for Pharaoh. And he will store it up right in the very cities of storage that he made them build. He'll do it right under their nose. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread it. Did it work? No. Rules of this world didn't apply to this people, apparently. Multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to what? Came to dread. Before it was just Pharaoh who came to dread them. Now it's who? All of Egypt has come to dread them. So the next step, of course, is to ramp it up. Pharaoh's plan, he's going to Pharaoh this. He's going to ramp it up. Make sure that it becomes more severe. These Egyptians subjected the Israelites to hard servitude, made their lives bitter with hard servitude and mortar and bricks and every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. They keep it. They ramp it up. Still doesn't work, apparently. So Pharaoh just comes up with another plan. He finally decides he's going to go from oppression to what? The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, the other Puah, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, what? Kill him. But if it's a daughter, she will what? She shall live. I don't want to even think about what they're doing with the women, but you can guess. In a nation of slaves, why they want the women. And why they sons. See, one of the problems, too, with a story as popular as this, that it has appeal, that nearly everybody knows the story of Egypt. Everyone does, whether they're believers or not, whether they're Jewish or Christian or any of them, they all know the story. Hollywood makes movies because people want to see this story. It is a compelling story. But the problem with it is that sometimes we don't sit with what actually is happening here. We don't sit with what really is going on. They're murdering what? Infants, babies, newborns, completely born, completely out. See, in ancient days, you didn't know whether it was a boy or a girl before. You had to wait till when? You had to wait till they were born. So after they were born. And I don't know if let's just say that every actor that they've ever gotten to portray Pharaoh, I hate each of them even more. You know. But what kills me here, too, is that Pharaoh's a coward, isn't he? Who's he going to get to carry out what he needs? Two midwives. Anyway. He commanded the midwives to do it. Did that work? Actually, no. The midwives feared him. They feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. And by the way, when he confronts them, they even are bold enough to lie to him about what actually is happening. Okay? They tell him a bold-faced lie. They said, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before we even get there. Is that true? No, they're delivering the women, but they're just not carrying out what Pharaoh wants them to. They're letting the boys live. They're letting the boys live. So it backfires. Scripture says that God dealt with the midwives and the people multiplied and became very strong. So even in the midst of mass murder that they're attempting, his people are still thriving. And because the midwives fear God, he gives them families. See, the thing is that the midwives, I think, have a little bit of understanding. How could you deliver an entire people's, every one of their babies, how could you do it and not begin to feel something for them? And I think that the midwives feel it too, because they're slaves too. Notice they don't get families until after they join up with the Hebrews, because they're slaves of Pharaoh too. But what are they doing with their slavery? They're actively what? They're rebelling with their slavery. And they're helping Israel do it too. There's no one else. It's just them. So since it doesn't work with the midwives, he just then tells every citizen. He commands every one of his people. Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you throw him into the Nile. I tried to get the midwives to do it. It's not happening. That plan didn't work. Now he's enlisting every citizen. By the way, we're already told that every citizen has come to dread them. I think this one might actually be a bit more successful. So I'm not sure that it could get any worse than this. And if you're looking for timing, if you're looking for, I don't know, something to where this would actually kind of make sense, if it were my plan, at what time would I do this? I think it's the absolute worst time for Moses to be born. And he is born at this time. At this time when Egypt is doing its best to make sure that he never gets born, it's at this time that Moses is born. Change chapters. A man from the house of Levi wouldn't marry the Levite woman. The woman conceived, bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine baby, she what? She hid him for 3 months. I want you to notice how bad it was. See, Patriarchs and Prophets says that she was knowing that Israel's deliverer was near. What is it that makes her decide to hide this baby? It implies that most women aren't hiding their babies. They're not even trying to. That's how bad that it's gotten. Patriarchs and Prophets says she decided not to sacrifice him, is the way that she puts it. I don't think we understand what the scripture's telling us. It's actually happening. And it's so bad that the mothers aren't even trying to protect their children. But Moses' mother, Yochevet, she hides him. She's successful for how long? She's successful for 3 months, it says. It's interesting. Why only 3 months? Why just hide him for 3 months? See, if this were any other baby, usually the older babies get, the more, maybe, less unruly they might be. They're not waking up at 2 a.m. anymore demanding food or anything like that. It seems to me the hardest time to hide the baby would be the first 3 months. That's how we know that something else is going on here, right? That maybe there are other plans for this baby. Nothing about what would make sense on earth and the powers to be, or the earthly side of the covenant, or this side, makes any sense at all. When she can hide him no longer, it says, when she can hide it no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him, plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the river. So, strategy-wise, if you want to hide the baby to keep it from being butchered and slaughtered like all the other babies, would you come up with this plan? Let's examine this plan real quick, okay? What could happen? Nothing could go wrong with this, right? A newborn baby in a basket on the second largest river in the world. Right? Full of crocodiles. I've seen some of them. Pretty good size. A 3-month-old baby would be a great snack. And oh, by the way, the Pharaoh wants that baby drowned in the river in the first place. This is her plan. This is what she decides to do. So if this is the plan, and if God really does have a plan for this baby, he's going to need operatives to pull this plan off, right? Is there anyone? Is there anyone out there that God could see to help him pull it off? Well, the first two operatives aren't men. The first two operatives he's going to use to pull it off are women. In fact, one of them might still be a girl. His sister stood at a distance to see what? See what happened to her. That's a loaded verse right there for a big sister. We'll get back to that. But the other woman is who? The daughter of Pharaoh. Came down to bathe at the river. While her attendants walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to get it. So Mary is his sister. She's there. Apparently, the author doesn't know why she's there. Patriarchs and Prophets says she's there apparently indifferent. No, she's a big sister. Just hang with me for just a minute. Ever since the little brat was born, what do you think the big sister may have thought a couple of times? Maybe she just wants to see what's going to happen. See, to me, that's why that is. She just wants to see what would happen to him. Not that she's there to protect it. Not that she's there to prevent it. She just wants to see what's going to happen. I'm a big brother. I know. But to me, Pharaoh's daughter, the one who has pulled this plan off in the first place, it's his daughter. And the story reminds us of who all of a sudden the power of Pharaoh is brought into the timeline. It's brought into the history of the covenant. How does this remind us? Reminds us of Joseph, right? Reminds us that Joseph pulls off his part of the covenant. He goes from being sold into slavery into who? Into nearly becoming Pharaoh himself. And again, you get the idea that, as I've pointed out before, that the Hollywood version is, this is the way that it happens. That the covenant needs this earthly power pull this off. And all I'm saying is, I think the Mosaic Covenant is doing everything it can to disabuse us of that notion. She steps in. And maybe we think that Moses needs this power. He's got to have to become a power broker to be able to pull this off the same way that Joseph did. See, I used to think that, but in order for that to be pulled off, then the Hollywood narrative has to be true. He has to be kept secret. For him to be in line with Pharaoh, the movie narrative of his identity being kept secret, he would have to grow up in secret in order to be able to pull that off. There's no way he can become Pharaoh if anybody knew he was Hebrew. With me? And the actual text, I don't think allows for it at all. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying. She took what? She took pity on him. This must be one of the Hebrews' children. She says it out loud. She knows exactly who he is. This must be one of the Hebrews' children. Now, if there's anybody that should know Pharaoh's edict, it should be his own daughter. What should she do right now? Drop him back in the river. Without the basket this time. Am I off? No. She knows, doesn't she? She even says it out loud, though. Anybody who's there, her maid is there, Miriam is there, we don't know who else is there. She says it out loud. This is one of the what? This is one of the Hebrews' children. And she looks at him, and she has the same reaction, almost, that his own mother did. She immediately knows who he is. By the way, one of the movies even allows for that. But as Miriam's purpose after the fact, like I said, whatever reason she's there after the fact, she has a purpose then for the covenant, because she immediately pipes up and says to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get you a nurse from those Hebrew women to nurse him? See, she can't, right? Can I do that? You think she might be able to pull that off? I think she can. She's not going to find any old Hebrew nursemaid. Who's she going to? Her own mom. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, yes. The girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you what? I'll give you wages. So the woman took the child and nursed it. There's nothing about this being kept secret. She's openly paying Moses' mom to nurse him. I don't think there's any efforts here to hide what's going on. Jochebed gets to nurse her own son. By the way, now with royal protection from the death decree. And being provided wages. It just might be that while Moses was living at home, his family didn't need to be slaves anymore. That this was their job now. To nurse this baby for who? For Pharaoh's daughter. He got to live in his natural home while being weaned. He got to hear the songs. He got to hear the prayers. And weaned, as far as we can tell, in the ancient times is no different than, say, from this time. Let's just say that probably the maximum age that Moses left home was 3 years old. So the one question going forward, if he leaves his own home when he's only 3, how much of his identity does it really understand and know? How many here remember something from the time they were 3? Not me. I'm blank. I get to be about 4 or 5, if I'm not sure about you. But to me, This one is the remarkable one. He's a baby in this. The remarkable one are these women. This one, especially right here. When the child what? When the child grew up, again, it is in the context of being weaned. Not grown completely up, but grown up. He's been weaned. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. By the way, who made the decision when it was time? His mom. Jochebed, that she brings him to Pharaoh's daughter, whom Haiti, and he and the Pharaoh's daughter immediately does what? Makes him her son. And she names him Moses. Why? Because I drew him out of the water. She's openly telling her father, her grandfather, her father, how she defied his order by giving him that name. She does it out loud. You think he's real thrilled with her now? You think he's real thrilled knowing that there's a baby running around that doesn't have his DNA in it? But it belongs to Daddy's little girl. And apparently Daddy's little girl, man, has some chutzpah. So apparently he gets to grow up, not just in Pharaoh's court, but he grows up as her son. She proclaims to her son, I drew him out of the water. It's not a secret. Something remarkable we don't think about. She openly defies her father's order to murder every Hebrew boy. Maybe he doesn't know for the first couple of years, but after a while she shows up one day with this kid and proclaims, I drew him from the water. She tells the old man she didn't kill him. She actually rescued him. He grows up in the royal family. And what he remembers about Hebrew and about being a Hebrew in contrast, I don't know, as compared to what he knows as grandson of Pharaoh. Which one do you think he remembers the most? Which one do you think he identifies with the most? By the way, the text doesn't help because it continues to go and it continues to remain completely vague. Because the text is more concerned with the narrative, it's more concerned about what's actually going on as to then whether or not his identity was kept a secret, whether or not he remembers being a Hebrew. The author says that's not the important thing. It's what happens is the important thing. So it says that when he had grown up, then it says, he went out one day. Okay. One day after Moses had grown up. One day after Moses had grown up. Now it's no longer in the context of weaning. Now he's actually what? Now he's actually grown up. Most rabbis think he's about 40 years old now. That he's actually grown up. He had grown up, he went out to his people, saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Again, the rabbis note that the scripture is even vague. He went out to his people, which could include Egyptians, right? And it's funny. You have one rabbi who says, no, his people, he understood, was Egyptians. The other rabbi says, no, his people were Hebrews. But look, the scripture says what? It says both. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Is he talking about the Egyptian? Or is he talking about the Hebrew? He looked this way and that, and seeing how many people that are concerned about this. None. There's not an Egyptian that's concerned about this. There's not another Hebrew that is concerned about this. And Moses decides that since there is no one, he's going to what? He's going to. He kills the Egyptian, and he hides him in the sand. So the first part of this narrative, some rabbis say that this indicates that he knows exactly who he is, that he's taking mercy on the Hebrew people because he's one of their own. But the next part, absolutely, this doesn't prove that. The next part, actually, is almost the opposite. When he went out the next day, he saw two Hebrews fighting. And when he said to the one who was in the wrong, why do you strike your fellow Hebrew? He answered, who made you ruler and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely this thing is known. See, nothing is clear from the text. If Moses is in line to be Pharaoh, what is he afraid of? Really?
If he's actually in line to be Pharaoh, should he be afraid of what he did the day before? All he's got to do is tell his dad. Right?
But he's afraid. And note who are the ones that betray him. The Hebrews. So he truly is a no one, isn't he? His identity is purposely described to us this way because the covenant isn't based on who your dad is. It never has been. I wish I would have heard louder again. Surely this thing is known. Those Hebrews who I thought wouldn't tell who I thought might have been a little bit moved by what I did to them the day before. It's they that do. And by the way, they do tell it because the very next verse says, when Pharaoh heard of it, who do you think he heard it from? He sought to what? He sought to kill Moses. So Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. See, to me, this proves to me that Grandpa knows all well who he is. He seeks to kill Moses as if his life is equal with just any other Egyptian. If he's in line to be Pharaoh, do you think his life is eye for eye?
No. No Pharaoh would say that. No Pharaoh would admit that. That's my grandson. Or my son. We're not 100% sure which one's talking right now. Moses proves his loyalty to Hebrew blood. Well, maybe. But it's to what we've been known all along. He has known. His daughter proclaimed him drawn from the water. See, so I used to think it was the idea that he was about to be Pharaoh, rising to power. And even if that were true, if it were true that the covenant was going to be pulled off by him rising up to this Egyptian power, then it would be predicated on his identity being kept well. Secret, and it doesn't look like it was. The covenant isn't based on power. It isn't based on what this world looks upon and says is powerful. It isn't based on who you can trace your ancestry back to. The covenant is supposed to be by what? By faith. This is what makes you a child of Abraham. Even if it is the other way, Moses still ends up where? In exile, sitting by a well in Midian. So in a way, the author's right. You guys are going to get all concerned about who Moses is and what he belongs to and everything else. But the point is this. Pharaoh, in line, in exile. Hebrew, in line, in exile. He doesn't have any of his identity. He's sitting by a well in Midian, a place that he does not know, a place he has no relatives in. Being introduced to a career change, by the way. Priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's well. We haven't met him yet, but we know what he does. What does he do? He's a shepherd. Or a goat herd, or both. Because his father has what? Flocks. That's right. And remember what happened is that they get bullied at the well. And Moses steps up and bullies them back. He's learned his lessons well, doesn't he? He steps up, bullies them back. So the daughters go back home and tell their father. He said, what are you doing back here? Why are you back here so early? And they explain to their father what happened. They said, an Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the well. Notice who they identify him as. They identify him as an Egyptian. And I don't know about you, but I'm marveled about how fast this happens. Okay? Is that number one, he invites him to a meal. And it says, and Moses agrees in this meal to what? To stay with them, and the guy just what? Gives him a daughter.
end up getting it. The contrast in how the men treat the women in this story versus how the narrative treats the women themselves, itself, is astounding, isn't it? And immediately, it appears, she bears him what? A son. And he names him Gershom. And this is what gets me, this is what's so telling. For I have been an alien, residing in a foreign land. By the way, welcome to the covenant. Remember, I believe that whoever God picks, the one kind of person that he picks on purpose, is somebody that has no money, no land, no nothing. They have nothing absolutely to depend on. And if you don't have the land providing for you, and if you don't believe that you should be worshiping the land, which is what people did, they worship the land, they worship their culture, they worship whoever they're from, they feel they must be blessed as long as they have these earthly blessings. All of the keepers of the covenant up until this point have been what? They've been aliens. No land, no nothing. And maybe, just maybe, you might turn to who to rely on. If that's the case. So Moses has nobody. He does not identify himself as an Egyptian anymore. He doesn't identify himself as a Hebrew anymore. I'm residing where? In a foreign land. That's why he names his son Gershom. By the way, Gershom is a proper name. It's used 118 times in Scripture. And you will always see it as a proper name. But it comes from the Hebrew root, Garash, which means to drive out or be driven out, to be cast out, to be dismissed, or be dispossessed. So he sounds like every other father of the covenant. Pharaoh's son. That's not what gets him here. Not actually a Hebrew slave. It's not what gets him here. What gets him here is God. No one else. He's a what? He's a no one. He's a nobody. See, the chapter kind of bears that out and kind of gives us, it says, after a long time the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned under their slavery, cried out. The cry for help arose up to God from their slavery. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all strangers in a strange land. Now that Moses is a stranger in a strange land, he now can begin to do what? He now can begin to say, who's taking the covenant next? Where is that man? And he looks. Is there a man worthy enough for it? No. But I'll pick this guy. I'll pick the no one. God heard their groaning, remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, Yaakov. God looked upon the Israelites, and God did what? He took notice of them. So the chapter ends with this being instilled in our exile from Pharaoh's family and from Hebrew's family in his exile. The man at the heart of the plan, the one that will be living proof of God's remembering his covenant, that eloquent voice I talked to you about, is this guy, one who keeps the flocks of his father. He doesn't even own the flocks. He is a shepherd for his father-in-law, Jethro, priest of Midian, leads his flock beyond the wilderness, came to Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. It's a shepherd at the foot of this mountain, of a flock he doesn't own, in a land he does not belong to, being completely alienated. God picks the no one. Not a pharaoh or any other heir, not a general or an architect or priest of all of Egypt's most powerful gods, not even an Egyptian citizen or a Hebrew slave. It's just a no one. Just the someone that God seems to have given the covenant to ever since he gave the covenant to. As a matter of fact, it seems to be a prerequisite to receive the covenant. You have to be a what? Have to be a no one. There's no one. three things of why we still want to buy into the secret identity, and that it was Moses getting hooked up with Pharaoh is what made all this happen, and being able to co-opt that power. How many here still want to believe that? There's a reason why we want to believe that. There's a reason why Hollywood makes such great, compelling movies about this. Number one, it plays exactly into what the world would define as blessed. This is what the world would require of the covenant. That you have to have riches and power, and you need to be able to get it, because if you're a slave or a member of an oppressed people, you're not going to get anything. We want this to happen. We want to think that the covenant could be pulled off as something we might be able to accomplish. With me? The second reason why we want to believe this is that without that secret upbringing that we've talked about, you have to note that the real heroes in this story aren't the men. The real heroes are who? The women. They're the ones that have none of the power that we're talking about. We want Moses to have that power because the women don't have that power. But look what the women do with their no power. Look what the women do with their no one status. They're the ones that pull this off. Slaves, midwives, defying Pharaoh's edict, risking their lives. Twice those midwives do it. Not obeying the edict, but also then lying to his face about why the boys are surviving. A slave biological mother who defies and hides till she can't hide him anymore. The slave older sister seizing an opportunity. And then this princess, this pagan princess, defies her tyrant father and not only saves the Hebrew baby, but pronounces that defiance by bringing that baby up in his court as her own. None of them have the power that the world wants and craves. But they have covenantal power. Because the power of the covenant belongs to who? He gives what is his own to who he wants to. And he's decided that when he gives the covenant away, he gives it to no one. The other reason why we still want to believe that it's the other way around is because we have a tendency to have been told that those patriarchs and matriarchs, by the way, were chosen because they were already special. That they were the lone stalwarts, that they were the lone people that were looking to be with God. They were the lone spiritual giants in all the world. And that's why they were chosen. Really? Let's just start with Abraham. Was Abraham that one lone spiritual giant willing to listen to God? No. He was worshiping other gods along with his brother, and then he was just another pagan. Isaac proves no better when it comes to his being tested of him. He doesn't have the faith that his father had or that his father didn't have. Jacob was the heel, the supplanter, the insidious advantage taker. We have no record, we don't even have a record of him even praying to God, even after being given the blessings of the covenant. Joseph's arrogance in adolescence, that selfishness, that's what gets him to Egypt. And his brother's raging jealousy. That's what's used to get him the power that it seemed that the covenant's posterity required. And now Moses, confused ancestry and citizenship, in exile, humiliated, or maybe just humble, a shepherd. But that's the guy. Not Pharaoh's son. Not Pharaoh. Looking for just one righteous person, there was no one. And by the way, in carrying out God's work, and especially going to work for the oppressed, you kind of already got the hint in the author himself, is that when it came time to live this out, when it came time to do something about it, Moses looks around and he sees what? He sees no one. He asks, yes, But apparently it makes no difference. Because the people that he saved reject him. The people that he was standing up to, they reject him. They tell him, get out and never come back. Who made you to be a ruler over us? By the way, next week, when God asks him to do this, you think those words are echoing in his ear? But why he doesn't want to go back to Egypt? You mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? There is no one that stands up for the oppressed. He'll even tell God, who am I? I am a nobody. And God will reveal to him the only thing that everyone needs to know about the covenant. The reason you have to be no one is because his plan is, I will win. I will be with you. I will be the sign. This will be the sign that is who that I am the one who sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Go get them. Bring them here. That will be the sign. Don't worry about any other signs. To our no one, he's the one. And that's what the prophet was saying. He saw that there was one. No one. And was appalled that there was no one to intervene. So his own arm brought him victory, and his righteousness upheld him. To our no one, he's what? He's the one. The living covenant is that God is the one living. And he's decided to give it to those who might as well be dead. For we were all dead in our trespasses at one time. But Christ died that death and raised us up. The covenant is living that out. In this covenant, even if you believe that Moses was some sort of spiritual giant, if you still believe that, who is still the one in this covenant? He is. He is. And by the way, when you read it from here on out, before you move on to Mount Horeb, just give the ladies a shout out, okay? Still introducing.